would be to cover the topic of parenting. So we'll start off this series. We'll tackle parenting for a few weeks. I don't know how many, but we'll do parenting. We'll shift it to marriage. We'll shift it to other things at times. But I thought we'll start off with parenting tonight. So I want to begin. Basically, we're gonna take a bird's eye view of some principles that are going to be helpful for us to keep in mind, really prerequisites to faithful biblical parenting. So we're not going to get into the specifics tonight of discipline and shepherding them in the truth, but really the macro level prerequisites that we should be striving for. And how I want to frame it up is this way. You know, what are the most important things to give our children to focus on as parents? When you hear that question, what comes to your mind? Another way we could ask it is this. When our children are grown up and they leave the home and they have independence, when time has passed, we're able to look back on the time that we have with our children, what will bring joy and peace to our souls as opposed to regret and guilt? What can we be doing now to ensure that the influence we had over our children was indeed pleasing to God? Okay? Now, I think it's important for us to consider questions like these because, for one, it's easy for us to become conditioned by the world and start to just have secular goals, secular gifts, so to speak, that we pass on to our children. You know, what are some examples or types of goals that we could be conditioned to seek after with our children that aren't necessarily sinful? They're not inherently evil. They just aren't distinctly Christian. What are some of those goals that we might become preoccupied with to the detriment of things we actually are called to?
Education,
absolutely. Right? We all want our children to have the best education possible, and we want them to, you know, we might even want them to go to college and expand their education and get a certain amount of education and degrees and these things. So that can be a goal that we can have, and we can view a successful parenting endeavor as, yes, they got the best education possible and I was able to pass them along to the institution and they're gone and I was a good parent for doing that. Okay, that's one.
Careers, yeah.
What about just how we view success? You know, how do we view success in parenting and also a successful child who leaves the home? What does that look like? We could very easily swing into the secular spectrum and think success is financial stability, a good career with plenty of money, a comfortable lifestyle. Now, that's good. I certainly want those things for my kids, but that if that becomes a goal, if that becomes how we view success, then we're going to prioritize that to the detriment of other things. Okay, marital status, we could put that in success. You know, do everything we can. My main goal is for them to marry him and have him find a Christian spouse and make sure everything works out from that angle. So those are goals that we can have. Now, the problem with those things is not that they're sinful desires necessarily. They can certainly become sinful when we prioritize them over other things. But what we have to recognize is that when our goals go no further than the things we just listed, we're really not accomplishing anything that the unbelieving world can accomplish with its children. So our parenting has to go farther. So tonight, I want to talk about things that are the most important gifts we can give to our children. The most important gifts that we can give. The things that might get typically pushed aside or obscured as we pursue mere horizontal goals with our children. So we're going to frame it up this way. Six gifts that all Christian parents should be regularly giving to their children. Six gifts that we should regularly be giving to our children. Pastor Jerry Ragg, that is Mark's uncle from Grace Emmanuel Bible Church, he had years ago taught on eight gifts of a father to his children. So borrowed some of these from that list and just kind of expanded and broadened a few of the principles to make it applicable to mom and dad. So six gifts, six invaluable gifts you can give to your children so that when you get back, when you look back on your time with them, you can say, yes, I was faithful and parenting was a success, in quotes. So the first invaluable gift you can give to your children is the fear of God in your life. Fear of God in your life. Let's look at Psalm 128 for this one. Psalm 128. You have these twin psalms here of Psalm 127 and 128. That have to do with the family and children and even marriage. So notice how the psalm begins. How blessed is everyone who fears the Lord, who walks in his ways. When you shall eat of the fruit of your hands, you will be happy and it will be well with you. So verse 1 is to really be the banner over our lives, those who fear the Lord and walk in his ways. Now, what's it mean to fear the Lord? If someone were to ask you, what's it mean to fear the Lord? What would you say? How would you respond?
A reverential awe.
A reverential awe, certainly. Anything else come to mind?
I think obedience.
What was that?
Obedience.
So an obedience motivated by that reverential awe, if we wanted to combine both of those. Yeah, I think practically it means my thinking, my speaking, my acting is controlled. It's governed by the Lord alone. In every context or circumstance, in thought or deed, my all-consuming ambition is to be pleasing to him. Even as one author said, it's the controlling sense of his majesty and holiness. 2 Corinthians 5:9, we make it our aim, our goal, to please him, to please him. And according to our passage here in Psalm 128, walking in the fear of the Lord results in putting yourself in a position of maximum blessing. Notice what the text says. You will be happy and it will be well with you. Now, sometimes the passage like that might make us nervous when we read that because we see it, you know, we see the abuse of passages like this in the health, wealth, and prosperity gospel. So we tend to reason these things away. But notice what the text says. You will be happy and it will be well with you. Now, we should clarify that doesn't mean you're not going to face hardship and that life is going to be easy. That's certainly not what that means. Now, you're going to experience difficulty no matter how godly and faithful you are. What's a prime example of that in the New Testament? Godliest man ever.
Content.
Right? Yeah, well, Paul, and then godliest God-man, Jesus, right? Who did not have an easy life, who suffered hardship, right? Though he was innocent. And Paul certainly suffered hardship, and while he was a sinner, he was faithful. He was consistently walking in the fear of the Lord. So this doesn't mean an easy, trial-free life, but it does mean that, first of all, you won't have any unnecessary trials, what we would call self-inflicted hardship, whether from the consequences of your own sin or the discipline of the Lord. It does mean that when you face difficulties, you're going to find grace to count it all joy, and you'll be sustained. You're going to have peace in those moments. Why? Because you have a good conscience, because you've walked in the fear of the Lord and in his ways. And if you fear the Lord and walked in his ways, the difficulties in life are never as intense as they could be. Because what is the worst part of our difficulties? The self-will, the unbelief that we have as we walk through them. So this blessed life here is the liberating freedom of fearing God alone. Think about all of the burdens, all of the thoughts that we're often consumed by and what other people are thinking, or what if this, and if I only had this. Well, the liberating power of fearing God alone eradicates those things. As Oswald Chambers has said, when you fear God, you fear nothing else. When you don't fear God, you fear everything else. Now, particularly for the husband and father, notice the effect in verse 3 of his fear of the Lord and walking in his ways. Your wife shall be like a fruitful vine within your house. Now, that's an interesting connection the psalmist makes. He talks about dad and husband fearing God, walking in his ways, and then he goes to an effect it's going to have on his wife. Your wife shall be like a fruitful vine within your house. It's a picture of flourishing. She's flourishing in the home. Now, husbands, when our wives aren't flourishing in the home, what is our temptation? And we can just protect ourselves and say, what have we heard from other men that the temptation might be? When our wives are really struggling, when they have sin or they have weakness, what's a husband typically, what's he going to be tempted to do in that moment? Is he going to immediately reflect on his own leadership and say, yeah, I could be contributing to that? Or is he going to be prone to do what? Yeah, of course. Yeah. I think the natural temptation is there's something wrong with her. This is her problem. It doesn't affect me at all. I have not contributed to this. Well, scriptures make a connection between our leadership and those under us, so much so that in one sense, a husband can say, the wife that I have is the wife I have produced. The psalmist is saying, as you fear the Lord and walk in his ways, you're creating an environment in the home that your wife can flourish in. Doesn't mean she won't have sin and weaknesses. Doesn't mean that when she sins that you're directly responsible. That would go against James 1, 13 to 15. But it will mean that your leadership hasn't significantly contributed to those things. She'll be more like Christ as a result of you, not despite of you. So a wife is made to respond to her husband's leadership, and when that leadership fears the Lord, she's now in an environment that she can flourish in. Now, what about your children? Well, notice the effect that your fear of the Lord has on your children. That's why it's a gift to them. Middle of verse 3. Your children will be like olive plants around your table. That's full of life and promise, not stunted in their development, morally or spiritually. It's another picture of flourishing under leadership. Now, again, there's that fierce temptation as parents when we're going through that season, when our kids are really acting up and out of control. And the temptation is, well, there's something uniquely wrong with my kids, and that's the difference between my kids and somebody else's kids who are in submission to their parents. I just got stuck with disobedient kids, and somebody else was lucky enough to get kids that aren't out of control as mine. Now, certainly not to say that some children aren't a little more difficult to shepherd and discipline than others. We would certainly acknowledge that. You can see the differences between your own children, I'm sure. But we must ask ourselves more questions, deeper questions, when our kids are undisciplined or out of control. There's an uninspired proverb that I think is pretty accurate in most cases. It goes like this: if the child's out of control, the parent is probably out of control. Right? In other words, an out of control child who doesn't respond to instruction and authority, where did they learn that? They've been conditioned. They've been conditioned to not respond to authority in the home. Now, one way this shows up when we've kind of bought into the lie that the children we have is not really the children we've produced in that sense. You know, what happens when we bring our children to someone else, a pastor, or maybe somebody else in the body for help? My son or daughter is wrestling through this thing. They're out of control, and we think it's going to be all about them talking to the child, but really the questions start coming toward the parent, and you're like, whoa, we didn't come here to talk about my parenting. We came here to talk about my child. You got to fix my child. Well, that's the lie that we believe. We have to try to demonstrate the reason the child's acting that way could be directly tied to inconsistent or negligent leadership. Notice verse 4 now. Behold, for thus shall the man be blessed who fears the Lord. The Lord bless you from Zion, and may you see the prosperity of Jerusalem all the days of your life. Indeed, may you see your children's children. Peace be upon Israel. It's a picture of a secure and thriving relationship with God, and a picture of the blessing of long life and a thriving family. We're in Psalm 128, for anybody who just came in, but only for another minute. So, this psalm really emphasizes the aura of God's blessing upon a family, when particularly the father and husband fears God and leads. So you live your life before God in conformity to his will. The fear of God in your life as parents, you can see right here, is one of the greatest gifts that you can give to your children. I think one helpful question you can ask your kids about yourself, and this is for mom or dad, ask them what they think is most important to you. What is most important to daddy? What's most important to mommy? Now, their answer isn't necessarily a reflection of what you love the most, but it's certainly a question worth asking. Why is that? Don't kids have the amazing ability to be brutally honest and innocently honest? at the same time. Meaning they'll tell you the truth as they see it, and they don't know enough to gauge how it's going to come across or how it's going to affect you. So they just state it how they see it. So ask them those questions based on the way I spend my time, what I do around the house, how I speak, what I prioritize, how I reason, what I get angry about, what does mom, what does dad value and love the most? It can be a very humbling question to ask them. I think over time, our children should be able to truthfully say, mom loves the Lord, first and foremost. You know, dad fears God, first and foremost. That's what dad values the most. So one of our children's greatest needs is parents who fear God and walk in his ways. Now, we're going to move on now to the second gift, and really the rest of these can all fall under the umbrella of this first one. I mean, that is really the entire gamut of the Christian life, to fear God and walk in his ways. So we're just looking at practical ways we do that now. The second gift, or area of priority as a parent, would be the joyful fulfillment of your marital roles. That is an invaluable gift you can give to your children. The joyful fulfillment of your marital roles. I want you guys to think back on your own childhood, and whether or not you came from a Christian family, let's just assume you did, for the sake of this illustration, you did come from a Christian family that did family devotions, okay? You might not remember the specific content of any family devotions that you had, especially when you were young. You remember the act of doing them, but you could very well have no specific recollection of anything, any specific content that mom or dad taught you in those moments. But you know what I can almost guarantee you do remember specifically about your childhood? You remember how dad treated mom and how mom treated dad. You think back and you can probably identify that. You remember if your dad was selfish or sacrificial, proud or humble, a leader, an active leader, or a passive negligent leader. You remember if your mom respected him and honored him or competed with him, trying to usurp his authority. You know, the very fact that we can remember these things demonstrates for us that another invaluable gift we can give to them is fulfilling marital roles biblically. This means, first of all, that husbands are to love mom sacrificially and exclusively. This is Ephesians 5:25-33. Very familiar to you, but we'll read it tonight. Ephesians 5:25. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her, so that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. So husbands also ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church, because we are members of his body. Now, that we could spend the rest of the night and 8 weeks into the future dealing with the implications and principles that come out of that, but really what stands out is a husband is to be out in front as a leader in love, even if he doesn't perceive his wife deserves it or appreciates it. That's verse 25, the sacrificing of himself for the good of his wife. That's the model, that's the picture of Christ in the church. So this is redemptive leadership promoting your wife's holiness. And you say, where do you get that? Verse 26, so that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word. So Christ did everything he could to promote the holiness of the church. He set the church apart and then gives the church resources to become like himself. That is redemptive, loving leadership. Now, let's just give the opposite of that and where we typically fail as husbands. We typically fail because we don't like to resolve conflict. That's one area. The husband should be the pursuer of reconciliation, not waiting for his wife to come around and initiate that. The husband's love is modeled after Christ, and Christ did not wait for the church. If he did, no one would be saved. He pursued her in her rebellious state and initiated the reconciliation process. And no, it doesn't mean your wife is always at fault. That's the picture of Christ in the church. 1 John 4:19, we love because he first loved us. Now, why is that hard for us as husbands? Pride. Pride. We don't want to humble ourselves. We don't want to do the hard work of resolving conflict. And this obviously implies we should be seeking forgiveness from our wives. We've all got to ask ourselves, when was the last time our wives heard those words? I sinned against you in this way. Will you forgive me? Will you forgive me? And we stopped there. We stopped there without adding some sort of rationalization to it, like I was tired or I worked long hours this week or the kids are really bugging me and that's why I acted the way I did. Or you pushed my buttons, you pushed me over the edge. No, we stopped. I sinned against you. Will you forgive me? Hard for us because we're proud. So we need to work hard at humbling ourselves, seeking forgiveness when we've sinned. This would also include developing convictions and being able to articulate the truth. Being able to articulate the truth. You know, we've got some strong women in our church who have great knowledge of the scriptures, and that's not a problem. It's not a problem if you're a man and your wife knows more scripture than you do. That's not necessarily a problem, but it is if you've been lazy and apathetic to the truth, and you're not growing alongside her and cultivating that appetite. You know, you don't want her to have to do those things despite of you because you're not leading. So the husband's convictions set the tone of the home, the trajectory of the family. So we've got to develop convictions. We've got to learn and grow how to develop them and articulate them. We'll talk about that a little bit later too. So husbands are to love mom sacrificially and exclusively. We're to be one woman men, as Paul says in Timothy and Titus. A wife should have no doubts whatsoever in her mind about her husband's commitment to her, his loyalty to her. So, children are watching how dad leads and loves mom, and how mom treats dad in response to him. This is next in verse 22. Wives are to respect, honor, and submit joyfully. Wives, be subject to your own husbands, as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. All right, so I just picked on the men. Let me hear from some of the wives. What makes submission difficult? What are some of the temptations that you face that makes it hard to do what Paul's saying here in Ephesians 5? Okay. Wanting to be in control and not voluntarily, which is what submission is. It's a voluntary response in giving up one's independent rights to come under another. That's submission in the scriptures. So absolutely. Wanting to control and wanting to control is just the unbelief. I'm not going to trust God in coming under this flawed leader here. Yeah.
In our knowledge, I'm guilty of that. Like, hey, I heard this today, and boy, was I wrong.
Yeah. Okay. So if we are in a context where we do have greater knowledge, we could tend to excuse ourselves from coming under his leadership because, after all, I know more than he does. Yeah, that'd be a temptation. Anything else?
Fear.
Yeah. Yeah, Peter makes that connection. We want to look at 1 Peter 3. Peter reiterates in 1 Peter 3:1, likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives. But skip down now. Remember, in a context here of submission, in verse 6, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you are her children if you do good and do not fear anything that is frightening. So one of the greatest enemies there of submission is fear. Fear. What if it's not wise? What if it's not this? What if the husband leads in this direction? So fear. Fear is certainly a temptation. So now let's ask this question. Why is it important to win that battle? What is at stake What is at stake in submission as it relates to your kids? We know what's at stake in the relationship, in the marriage relationship, but what's at stake as it relates to kids with a wife's submission? Well, how many times a day, and we probably can't even count how many times this is going to be, but how many times a day does mom tell her kids to do something, and if they don't do it, they are disciplined? They experience consequences. Happens a lot, depending on how young the kids are, for sure. Why does mom discipline them in those moments when they disobey mom, what mom has said? Because to dishonor the authority God has put in place is to dishonor God. And we're teaching our children how to respond to authority. So what happens when a wife places that expectation on her children, but then doesn't do that in her own life with her husband? Well, what is that? What's the Bible call that?
Hypocrisy.
It's an expression of hypocrisy which exasperates children. Why do the kids have to obey mom when mom doesn't come under the authority that God has put in her place? So that's a temptation for a wife. You know, I'll follow him as long as he's worth following. I'll follow him as long as he's compelling enough. If he's worthy of respect, as long as he's fulfilling his end of the deal and loving me the way he's called to, then I'll follow him. Well, what if our kids did that with us? You ever thought about? We would never let him get away with that. Yeah, I'll follow you today, Dad or Mom, if you've been perfect, if you're worthy of following. No, we would never let him get away with that, and appropriately so. They're not called to follow us because we're flawless. They're called to follow us because God has put us in that position. So I bring that up because there's much more at stake in a wife's submission than merely her relationship with her husband. There's continuity between that and her parenting. It's also critical for her to honor and respect her husband. And interestingly, that's another idea, overlapping idea between marriage and parenting. You know, our children are called to honor us, right? Not only obey us, but honor us with the right attitude in their obedience. Even though sometimes we have to admit we are not worthy of that honor. We are not worthy of that respect, and yet they are called to do it. Well, the same is true for a wife. She is to honor and respect her husband, affirm his leadership, and help him use his gifts to accomplish his tasks in life. Proverbs 12:4, an excellent wife is the crown of her husband, but she who shames him is like rottenness in his bones. You know, a consuming internal disease that just eats away at him. What is that? That's talking about the one flesh principle of marriage, right? It means that nothing either one of you do doesn't significantly affect the other. And Paul gives the summary now in verse 33. Nevertheless, each individual among you is also to love his own wife even as himself, and the wife must see to it that she respects her husband. So children are going to remember from these years how parents interacted with one another, loved one another, and respected one another. That is a valuable gift to give to your children. A stable home life as mom and dad fulfill their God-given roles. All right, a third gift, a third invaluable gift to give to our children. A growing faith, a growing faith. As parents, we are to lead our children to trust the sovereign purposes of God. Now, again, I always want to hone in on the husbands and fathers first. We have to be exemplary in this area, leading the family with patience. Patience and faith when trials and pressures come. Our kids need to see us trusting God even when we can't see the way out. Right? That is what faith is described as. If you look at Hebrews 11, trusting God when we have no earthly motivation, no earthly evidence to see that he's going to come through on his promise. Hebrews 11:1, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen, not felt. You can't see it, you can't touch it, you don't have the evidence right in front of you to believe. So like Abraham in Romans 4:20, hope against hope. What is that? It's believing against circumstances. Against circumstances. See, the legacy we leave our children should not be one of unbelief, especially for dad. And if he's regularly trusting God, it won't be. But what happens? What happens when dad or husband doesn't trust God consistently in the home? What happens? Yeah, I mean, just think about the connection we made in Psalm 128 there. If dad's not fearing the Lord and walking in his ways, and we would include in that belief, trusting the Lord, then there's going to be destruction in his path. There's going to be chaos in his family life. He's going to contribute to his wife's fears and his wife's anxieties. He's going to fuel them instead of help shepherd her through those things. And then moms also. Moms and wives, if you have uncrucified fears, and you're constantly expressing those things in front of the kids, expressing discontentment, complaining, you're teaching your kids. You're teaching them in that moment. You're teaching them, here's how to respond when life doesn't go, your way, here's how to respond. That's what you're teaching them. And then later on that day, when you're trying to memorize scripture with them and you come across Philippians 2 and it says, do all things without complaining, what do they think when they're old enough to make that connection? Hypocrisy, right? Mom, I just saw you complain all morning about this circumstance, and now you're telling me I've got to obey God in this. Well, if we have kids who are always expressing discontentment, always complaining, we've got to evaluate, have they learned that from us? Have they learned that from us? See, if we are allowed to complain as parents, but we have a zero tolerance policy for our kids, that's going to exasperate them. That's hypocrisy as well. I've heard it wisely said, the only thing worse than hearing a child complain is hearing an adult complain. That's true. The only difference is the adult just doesn't whine and cry. It's just a more sophisticated form, but it's really the same exact heart. I don't like how my life is going in this particular circumstance. So, in contrast to that, a growing faith in the sovereign purposes of God is a great gift to give your kids, modeling for them how to respond when inconveniences come, when trials and pressure come, when suffering comes. You know, we have to teach them that God has ordained difficult circumstances to build endurance, to strengthen faith, to give assurance. And we teach them God is good and faithful and wise, never to be questioned. Never to be questioned. A fourth one. I would say remember them all, but if you're only going to remember one, remember this one. Okay? A fourth invaluable gift we should give our children, a pattern of transparent humility in the home. A pattern of transparent humility. I would say, in my experience thus far in ministry, and just even noticing the temptations in my own heart, this one is the one that's often most lacking in Christian homes, and yet it's one of the most important. Parents living a humble life by examining and assessing their own lives with biblical honesty. Practically speaking, this means that we as parents admit when we're wrong to the family, to the kids, when we've sinned, in the presence of everyone who experienced the sin. So we've got to ask the same question we ask when we recover in marriage. When is the last time you sought forgiveness from one of your children? And you say, what for? Well, have you ever disciplined them in anger? Have you ever used corrupting speech toward them, snapped at them, become irritable? Or have you had an inconsistent standard where one week you were consistent in discipline for this particular activity or behavior they were doing, but then the next week they kept doing it, but you never addressed it? So an inconsistent standard. So we've got to recognize, you know, do our children consistently have their sin and weaknesses exposed and held under a magnifying glass, while ours are consistently overlooked and rarely, if ever, brought up? Now, you might be saying, well, they're two. They don't understand what I'm saying when I ask for forgiveness from them, so what's the point? Well, maybe not, but I would turn it back around and say, what would be the problem? What's the danger of confessing your sin to a two-year-old? What's the problem with putting a pattern of seeking forgiveness in place with them while they're young, so then when they do get old enough, the pattern's there, and now you have the momentum going, and you're just maintaining that momentum? I can't think of any danger of starting too young with this. It would be great if they couldn't even remember a time when mom or dad wasn't doing this. As far back as I can remember, mom was always confessing when she was wrong, and dad was always willing to own it when he had weaknesses and sin. That'd be a great testimony. Now, when we discuss this transparent humility, we have to discuss its ugly counterpart, pride. The pride of irritability and anger, which I promised was coming tonight. So irritability and anger, this is a common one for parents. Jerry as well wrote an essay on irritability. I'm going to take a few highlights from that and just expand on it a little bit. We know the only kind of anger that achieves kingdom purposes is righteous anger. This is anger at the things that offend God. And no, we can't demonstrate anger perfectly like God does, but we can become so filled with his truth that we see the offenses of others through his frame of reference. Well, this is especially crucial for parents when it comes to how they deal with their children. Parents many times become angry due to selfishness in their own hearts, desiring to have life in the home a certain way. So here's how I would call it. I would say anger is really the result of having unbiblical expectations about what home life should look like. Anger and irritability involve unbiblical expectations from others and unbiblical rights for yourself. And when these unbiblical expectations aren't met, the result is anger and abusive words. Ephesians 4:29, let no corrupting speech proceed from your mouth, but only as such is good for building up as fits the occasion, so that it may give grace to those who hear. You know, there are certain verses in Scripture that have the ability to just completely devastate. Just one verse. Let no corrupting speech proceed from your mouth, but only such as is good for building up. So when we talk to our children, do our words tear down or build up? When we talk to them, are we encouraging them to do what is right, giving grace to those who hear, or are we tearing them down, merely condemning? Now, it's not to say that we don't have to firmly tell them that their sin is wrong and it's going to ruin their life, that left to itself, they're going to be a fool, that sin is despicable in the sight of God. We have to say those things, but we must, through loving discipline and constant call to repentance, drive the foolishness far from them. Proverbs 22:15. But if we express those truths through abusive, angry words, an angry tone, what are we going to do? We're going to drive our children to despair. We'll drive them to despair. And the subtle forms of anger are just as dangerous as the blatant outbursts. You know, the more subtle forms are the irritability. You know, just you're always on edge, irritated easily. What is irritability? Internal anger that hasn't found its fullest expression, or that you're able to keep a lid on without blowing up, but it's all in there. It's the kind of attitude that says, nothing is to inconvenience me today. I don't want the impingement of family, children, or anything else bothering me. So an irritable person is someone who is not willing to tolerate inconveniences in life. Now, what is the irony about that? Is there anything more inconvenient than kids? You know, it is foolish to think that when we... What's that?
Jehovah's Witness and Mormons.
Okay. Yeah, maybe if you're in a compound where they're all around or something. Yeah. You know, in all our years of parenting, it is foolish to think that we could enter in with that expectation, that it's going to be convenient and nothing's ever going to bother me or make any demands on me. The question for us is, do we respond with belief or unbelief to life's inconveniences? It is a matter of belief. Do we respond in truth, knowing that these inconveniences are allowed by God so that we're strengthened and encouraged, so that we grow? Or do we respond in unbelief, complaining, impatience, anger? See, when we're irritable, we're demonstrating a lack of trust in God's sovereignty and his ability to use our trials in sanctification. We're denying that God brought this providential inconvenience right into our life there at that time. And if we want to keep from exasperating our children, if we want to be the kind of parent who's open to how life unfolds on a daily basis, we have to stop demanding fair treatment in life, which is really all we're doing in those moments. When we respond out of anger, when we get irritable, we're buying into the lie, I deserve better treatment. This is unjust. Now, if you if you're someone here tonight and you haven't stopped using that vocabulary, this isn't fair. It's a good resolution from this point on. Just get rid of it. There are a few phrases I can think of that don't fit in a biblical worldview more than that phrase. This isn't fair. I mean, think about how many truths you have to deny about yourself and about God for that to be true. So we can't demand fair treatment in speech or indirectly in how we respond to inconveniences. What do we have to teach our kids? Teach them life isn't fair. No, life isn't fair, or at least it will seem unfair at times. And teach them how to be thankful in that circumstance, in that as long as they aren't in hell, they're deserving better, they're getting better than what they deserve. And then you respond the same way when you get bothered. So when you're at home and your children are demanding all this time and attention, you simply say, Lord, you're unfolding your plan for me right now. You're testing my faith. And this is a ministry moment, as Ted Tripp calls it. Every difficult moment, every interruption, every inconvenience is a ministry moment. And when you do fail, because we all will, confess that to them. When you get irritable, confess that to your kids so that they're not exasperated by hypocrisy. Okay, a fifth invaluable gift we can give to our children. Let's see how we're doing here. Faithfulness. Faithfulness expressed in regularity, predictability, consistency. Again, first for fathers. A father must hold convictions firmly with predictable responses to pressure. In other words, the family should be able to predict how dad will respond to life and why dad makes decisions and reasons through things the way he does. So there should be an apparent dedication to the scriptures in dad's responses and discussions. For the men, I think one of the greatest compliments you can get from your kids or your wife would be something like this. Before I even came to you with this issue or this question, I not only knew you would go to the scriptures, I knew what verse you were going to use to help me think through it. What a compliment that would be. Predictability. You've modeled a consistent pattern of faithfulness to the scriptures, if they can say that of you. So you're not, what's that mean then? You're not governed by emotions. You're not governed by circumstances. No, you're governed by the truth in all things. The same would be true for a wife, but I want to hone in on for the wife is her overall temperament in the home. A father, in many ways, sets the spiritual tone of the home, and the home goes as the father leads. But the wife, in many ways, sets the, for lack of a better word, the emotional tone of the home. Proverbs 19:13, that the contentions of a wife are a constant dripping. So that's a picture of a nagging, unrelenting drip from the ceiling. Now, what does an unrelenting leak do to a home if it doesn't get fixed? Destroys it. It makes it uninhabitable, right? Earlier on in Proverbs 14:1, the wisest of women builds her house, but folly with her own hands tears it down. So we've even heard that phrase, you know, if mom's not happy, nobody's happy. That's true in many ways in the home. Moms have to understand their temperament affects the tone of the home for better or worse. Now, I obviously am not pretending to understand the anatomy of the female body or everything that happens there with the hormonal fluctuations on a monthly basis. I've never experienced it. I don't want to. It looks very, very difficult. But it's important to bring that up when we're talking about this discussion. Because if you find those times particularly difficult, the Lord is certainly gracious and patient when we're weak, but you can't go through those times as if you get a free pass. Right? In other words, you don't want your husband and children to say, all right, everybody stay away from mom for a couple of days. You know, she's just turned into a different person and she's going to sin against everybody. You don't want them to have to do that. You know, 1 Corinthians 10:13 applies to all of life, including when our body is going through changes. And what does Paul say there? No temptation's overtaken you, but such as is common to man, and God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also so that you will be able to endure it. What's the principle there? There's no circumstance in life that you can't righteously respond in, where sin is the only option. So moms, you've got to strive to be regular and predictable and consistent in your demeanor. And that may mean, okay, if I struggle during certain times, then I've got to go hard before those times. I got to get equipped going over into those times so that when the temptation comes, I'm not taken captive by it. So a predictability, a consistency, faithfulness, that's a great gift to give to your children. And then we'll end with an obvious one, and then we can open it up for any thoughts or questions you guys have. A sixth invaluable gift is the truth, the scriptures, the gospel. Spurgeon said this, "If sinners be damned, at least let them leap to hell over our dead bodies. And if they perish, let them perish with our arms wrapped about their knees, imploring them to stay. If hell must be filled, let it be filled in the teeth of our exertions, and not one go unwarned and unprayed for." You know, there should be an appropriate amount of shame on us if our children can live with us year after year and have no clarity about the gospel. You know, it's grieving to see how so many young people today who, upon gaining independence, who grew up in a Christian home, they leave, they reject what their parents believe, and when they talk about what it is that they're rejecting, it's not even the gospel. They don't even know the truth. They're rejecting some hypocritical form of Christianity. So we've got to cultivate a truth-centered home where we're affirming in word and deed the authority of the scriptures. So God's word interprets all other facts, all of life. Any questions about life or the spiritual life or morality, we're going to the scriptures. It has the final say. It doesn't just contain truth, it is truth. So it's the measuring rod for all other facts. And a home where we're also affirming the sufficiency of scriptures. Well, no matter what problem we're facing in life, we know, as Peter tells us, that we have everything we need for life and godliness through the knowledge of the one who called us. So that's the type of a truth-saturated home that we want to give to our children. We see it in Deuteronomy 6:4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. These words which I'm commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. What's the point? The truth is to prevail in your thought life, conversations inside, outside the home, from the beginning of the day to the end. There's no area of life that the truth is not to dominate. Now, I thought of family devotions. The family devotions are great. Great to do. Family devotions devoid of a home life saturated with the truth are not going to accomplish much. In other words, if we have a compartmentalized home life, what do I mean by that? It means that we have our spiritual time for 10 minutes in the morning where we read scripture, or 10 minutes at night, or an hour at night, or whatever it might be. But then we never talk about the truth. There's no tone in the home where we're reasoning through the truth and talking about the implications and how it relates to life. Then there's a disconnect there. We need to constantly be bringing the truth to bear in all circumstances so that our children can see how the truth relates to life, how it applies to life. Paul picks up the principle of Deuteronomy there in Ephesians 6:4. Fathers, don't provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Bring your children to know and respect the instruction of the Lord. Now you say, well, I'm not equipped to do that. I don't know how to do that. You know, and I fear that if I start to talk about the truth at that level, then my family's going to realize I don't know anything. So then what do I do? I don't know how to think through the implications. What then? Well, I hope that happens. That'd be a blessing. That'd be a grace. Because then you can see your desperate need to grow in your knowledge and how you interact with the truth, and you can avail yourself of all the means of ways to grow in the body here. But the question would be, how long have you realized that about yourself, and what have you done about it? What have you done about it? Because especially if you're a husband and father, you are called to that. You are called to constantly allow the truth to inform every discussion that you're having and help your children, shepherd them in that. So what are you doing to increase your ability to have a functional and working knowledge of the scriptures besides the Lord's Day? What type of exposure do you have to the people of God and the truth? So, a sixth invaluable gift to give our children, the truth of the Scriptures. The truth about who they are, who God is, and what God has done in the person and work of Christ to save sinners. Now, obviously, we could list a lot of other gifts. I just wanted to lay a few foundations tonight as we start to talk about parenting and talk about some prerequisites to faithful parenting, which is really what these are. So,